afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
Well, good afternoon, Melody.
And
Tuesday. I thought fleeting this afternoon about what we call today. Alas, my first Tuesday broadcast with you will be just Tuesday for now.
Just Tuesday, Tuesday. Not Monday, Monday, but Tuesday, Tuesday.
Oh,
well, gold today, it was a Tuesday for gold. It was up $13 in the New York spot price aftermarket. Right now at $1,746, silver was up another 35 cents, a little over 2% at $1,742. Platinum was up 3%, up $25 at $836. Palladium was up 45 at $2,125. The USDX today was down 0.15 at 99.47. Crude oil was up 0.54 at 32.36. And we have the paper markets today. We have the Dow down 367 points at 24,229. The NASDAQ was down 40, 9,194. The S&P was down 30 at 2,922. 10-year yield 0.71%. And, you know, it was Asia market was stronger, Europeans. Markets were weaker. So, and it's just the toss up, going back and forth. Bear market, not so much. Recession, it's just V-shape. I mean, it's just kind of ridiculous until we get the final numbers to see exactly where we're at and so forth. But things still are looking a little difficult out there, Dave.
Excuse my interruption before sure. you get into today's stories. The design, I call it design, of the president's signature?
Yes.
I have a feeling that this recovery is going to be something like that.
Yes.
A lot of gyrating
ups and downs.
Yes. Not anything close to resembling a V or a W.
I agree. But, anytime we get that little blip of a V, that's all you're going to hear about. And but there is another sign, the home building, U.S. home building, that dropped by the most on record in April. Both and building permits for future construction, that also tumbled. Today's report from the Commerce Department added to dismal data this month, showing that a staggering loss of 20.5 million jobs in April and a collapse in retail sales and manufacturing production. Housing starts tumbled 30.2% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 891,000 units last month, and that's the lowest level since 2015. And, of course, the percentage decline was the biggest on record. Housing starts dropped almost 30%. Let's see if there's anything else in there. Nah, what do you got, Dave?
Well, just building permits for future home construction plunged 21% to a rate of slightly over 1 million units. And again, that's the lowest level since January of 2015. Economists are blah, blah, blah. That, I guess, single-family home building, which accounts for the largest share of the housing market, dropped 25%. Single-family building permits declined 24% as well. Now, in the volatile multifamily housing segment, starts took a nosedive of 40%, while building permits for the same fell 14%.
Wow.
It's a big drop in 1 month.
Yes, it is. California is asking Congress for $1 trillion. The task force includes from the governor's office, he has a business task force that is calling on Congress. And of course, it includes the typical high-profile business executives in the state, including Disney Executive Chair Bob Iger, Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff, Netflix Chief Content Advisor Ted Sarandos. The House already passed a new relief package just last week that includes $1 trillion in funding for state and local governments, but of course, we all know that's not going to be passed by the Senate, Dave.
Well, in other news briefs, Amazon said it's delivered more than 100 million medical items to frontline workers and government agencies during the pandemic. Amazon said more than 20,000 customers has used its site to secure essential supplies with PPE and janitorial sanitation products like medical-grade disinfectant solutions, not edible, by the way, being the most popular. And on another front, the elitist World Economic Forum is warning that the road to recover could be a long one unless more is done to secure a quick rebound. Good luck with that. We'll report more on that in tomorrow's program. And last, go ahead, Melody.
No, I'm done. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and last, it appears that the agreement reached between German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French Pres Emmanuel Macron over a 500 billion euro aid package, it's about $550 billion. The aid package for the EU is being widely welcomed by everyone from Italian bondholders to new ECB President Christine Lagarde. However, the agreement of all EU member states is needed for the measure to progress, with some, including Austria, already expressing reluctance.
I think they're going to go ahead and do it this time, but I was reading earlier where French President Macron, he's losing all of his supporters, so he's not going to make it another election.
Another
I don't know
term.
When that, another term. Yeah, he's not going to make it another term. And I mean, 500 billion euro. I mean, considering that the European Union has been shut down for how many months, that's just peanuts. That's not going to cover anything. This is just a gesture to say, you know, let's just get us through this one little bleep and maybe we can round up some other people to buy our debt and so forth. Yeah, I don't think the European Union's going to survive this, but we'll see. And that doesn't mean that the European Union is going to fall apart, you know, in 2 months. You know, it does take time. I mean, look how long it took Brexit to happen. What, 5 years? Six, you know, I mean, it was a long time. But there was no big, you know, tsunami.
The beginning of the end?
Yeah, you know. I mean, it went on relatively at this point in time. Because, of course, we don't get all the real facts. We don't get to know the behind-the-scenes discussions. But, you know, we talk about, you know, job losses due to, you know, the country being shut down. And it's also affecting the healthcare industry. And you would think that with the virus being a healthcare problem that you wouldn't see job losses in that area. But last week's gloomy jobs report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics did point out that the healthcare industry lost more than 1.4 million jobs in April. And of course, this is mainly due to the outpatient care is basically no longer has dried up. More than 4 out of 5 of those lost jobs were at offices for dentists, physicians, chiropractors, and other outpatient settings. Technicians, billing clerks, medical assistants who work in outpatient settings, many of whom are not highly paid, of course, are the ones that felt the brunt of the job losses. And we're not sure if this is going to be a quick return. A lot of the experts say don't expect that, even as elective procedures are able to come back online. Of all the places people want to come back to quickly, of course, the healthcare setting is probably not at the top of the list at this moment, Dave.
Yeah, indeed, Melody. I mean, most of the new jobs that are being filled in healthcare are administrative in nature. And, you know, certainly I wouldn't consider them or many of them on the front line, although with all due respect, I'm sure some of them might beg to differ in very closed quarter offices. So
today, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told senators that his department and the Fed are just fully prepared to take losses in certain scenarios. On the capital remaining to be distributed under the CARES Act, Mnuchin did not describe the certain scenarios in which he's prepared to take losses. Well, I'm glad he's prepared to take losses. How about asking the American people if they're prepared to take losses? But he did emphasize that the Treasury is ready to distribute the entire $500 billion initially appropriated to help struggling businesses impacted by the virus pandemic. I thought they were already supposed to distribute the entire $500 billion. I thought that was...
One would think. I mean, that was a top priority. Now, as he clarified, I mean, it's been approved, but not all has been distributed. In fact, you know, more than 50% of it hasn't been.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, it's... I don't have anything to say on that. I mean, it's just...
I got a kick out of his genteel politeness. I've never heard members of the Senate addressed as Mr. or Ms. Senator. Mr. Senate. And that's how Secretary Mnuchin addressed them in his responses. I'm not mocking him or being sarcastic. I'm just noting that I've never heard anyone refer to them as Mr., Ms., or Mrs. Senator. Usually it's just Senator or Senator X, Senator Y, what have you. Anyway, certainly he had to know that he was, both he and Powell were on the hot seat, I suspect. I mean, at least as the parts I watched, Mnuchin.
Well, not from the Senate. I wouldn't think either one of them would be on the hot seat from the Senate.
Well, Democrats, members. Yeah. Democratic members really laid into both of them, particularly Mnuchin.
I didn't watch it. Why did they?
Well, for Mnuchin, it was largely the two-pronged, the amount of time it's taking to get all of the first round of PPP loans out to people. Secondly, the alleged lack, and having gone through the Treasury website now, you know, I would concur that there's a lack of transparency by Mnuchin in particular, who has not disclosed any of the recipients on the website. He claimed, and during his testimony, that wasn't that he had some discretion there, and rightly claimed that aggregate numbers, like in categories of business types, of bank types, of bank size, the lender size, you know, all of that's on all those numbers are on the charts. But people want to know, and certainly have a right to know, who are the recipients, and whether they're private or public companies. I mean, it seems to me there's no privacy issue that overrides the American people's, the taxpayers' right to have access to that information. But so far, not there. So that was two. There was one other criticism leveled at Mnuchin, which is slipping my mind right now. Powell did get some tough questioning, but nothing stood out.
Yeah, Mnuchin just disturbs me. I don't know. He just has that. I just don't know. You know, he cracks me up, and he just has that look, like I know something you don't.
Yeah, I know.
I kind of think it's funny, but anyway, you know, when we talk about Wall Street, more than 2/3 of professional investors doubt that the stock market jump off the March lows is the start of a legitimate new bull market. Now, this is from a survey for May for Bank of America's fund manager survey. Amid a surge that has seen the S&P 500 rise 32% since the March 23rd bottom, 68% of survey respondents called the move a bear market rally. The term implies that even though the surge tops the 20% benchmark that would signal a new bull market, the fundamentals tell a little bit more of a pessimistic story. And, you know, Bank of America poll is among the most widely followed surveys of investors on Wall Street. So with that said, respondents still see the near-term pain trade, or the one that catches most investors off guard, as the market's going higher. Current sentiment is consistent with the S&P 500 level of 3,000, or about 2.3%, higher than yesterday's close. And so, Dave, there's other folks out there who think like we do.
Hey, what do you know? Maybe, I mean, 68%, that's a big chunk.
Yeah.
A healthy chunk of the professional investors. Now, as we know, the slide over the last month was the quickest descent ever into bear market territory. And since then, the Fed and other central banks around the world have stormed in with cash infusions and have been joined by a U.S. Congress that's already appropriated nearly $3 trillion in rescue funding. Now, survey respondents consider the biggest catalyst for the V-shaped recovery to be a vaccine. Not surprising. Conversely, they see the biggest risk to be a second wave that comes in the fall. Views on what companies should do with their own cash reflect changing market attitudes. 3/4 of them said they should focus on improving balance sheets and, listen to this, Melody, paying down their debt, while just 15% favored capital expenditures and 7 said it should be returned to shareholders via buybacks and dividends.
Well, I hear the music, and we're heading into the first break of the program today. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
We will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule the world.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk TimeUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter. And 30% of Americans have dipped into their 401k plans. I believe there was a little catch in the first care package that allowed seniors to dip into their retirement accounts, that allowed them to do it without penalty. And I guess they did that. So a new survey has found that 3 in 10 Americans had dipped into their retirement accounts due to the coronavirus. Another 19% said that they plan on doing so but haven't yet, meaning roughly half of Americans either have or will tap into the retirement savings to help them get through the current crisis. But what's interesting, Dave, I mean, yeah, I get there's still people that are working, but a lot of these folks are retired. So you would think that their income would not change. I mean, I've certainly seen dividends end. You know, maybe that's how they're being impacted, those that have retired, dividends, and, you know, I'm sure not all their stocks have come back. Maybe they are getting hit.
Well, I think this survey is everybody, but so I would guess that it's predominantly non-retirees that they're talking about having dipped into their 401ks. Because it doesn't, I don't believe it talked about, it is open, 401ks or other retirement accounts, so that would include IRAs, but you know, if you're older than 59 and a half, you're already able to dip into that penalty-free, essentially. 401ks is slightly different if you're still working, but anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, but it is kind of interesting. The survey also found that 60% of those who withdrawn money from the retirement accounts say they regret their decision to do so.
Yeah, I'll bet. I'll bet.
But it also tells you 60%, well, notably 77% plan to pay back those funds. Yeah, that's what everybody says.
I know.
Yeah, sure, I'm going to pay them back.
Well, therein lies that high regret level, I bet.
Yes.
That, you know, they plan to, but they think in their back of their heads, will I be able to?
That is exactly correct. And usually one, it's a little harder to pay back.
Well, just short of 50% of retirement savers have either stopped or have lowered their retirement contributions. 21% reduced, 26% stopped altogether. Baby boomers, interestingly, 53% stopped their contributions. On the other end of the age scale, just 17% of millennials have paused their contributions, and just 10% of Generation Zers. In any event, of those obligated normally to take the minimum required distributions, most of them are over 70 and a half. There are some who inherited IRAs that have to take an RMD, depending on the age of, usually it's a parent who died, who probably was over 70 and a half. 56% plan to skip the so-called RMD this year, another provision in the CARES Act.
Well, you know, you wrote in our newsletter, you wrote an article about the prospects of an economic depression versus a recession. So why don't you tell us about your article, Dave?
Well, yeah, we'll go into it a little bit. It's almost old news today, but Fed Chair Jerome Powell told a 60 Minutes audience the other night that unemployment will look a lot like it did during the 1930s when the rate peaked at around 25%, just shy of it. In fact, he added joblessness could exceed 30%, but the U.S. economy will avoid a depression-esque dive. Specifically, Powell told 60 Minutes host Scott Pelley, "I think there are a range of perspectives, but those numbers, 20 to 25%, sound about right for what the peak may be." Now, pressed on whether the U.S. is headed for a second depression, he replied, "I don't think that's a likely outcome at all. There's some very fundamental differences. Regardless of whether we're headed for the dreaded D word, the fact that we're even mentioning it, Melody, is cause for serious concern and reflection."
It is, and I think you brought something good to this article, is because people do throw the words depression and recession around, with perhaps not knowing the deep difference or the fundamentals for each. But I do disagree with Powell when he says that the fundamentals today are different than what they were during the Depression. But go ahead.
There's a lot. There's a lot the same.
And yes.
I mean, particularly one that we'll get to in a minute. But the difference between a depression and a recession. Well, there's an old saying among economists: a recession is when your neighbor loses his job. A depression is when you lose yours. The National Bureau, of course, tongue-in-cheek, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which officially declares recessions and depressions, defines a recession as a significant decline in economic activity. The downturn is spread across the economy, lasting more than a few months, usually two quarters at a minimum, and is normally visible in drops in real GDP, real income, employment, industrial production, and wholesale retail sales. Now, a depression is a severe and prolonged downturn, essentially an extreme recession that lasts three or more years, or which leads to a decline in real GDP of at least 10% in one given year. Now, by definitions, depressions are much less frequent than recessions. Since 1854, there have been 33 recessions and just one depression in the U.S., at least according to the NBER. Depressions tend to be accompanied by high unemployment and low inflation, plunging consumer confidence, and a collapse in investments, literally causing the economy to shut down. Sound familiar, Melody?
Yes, it does. And, you know, there's many economists that disagree on the duration of depressions. Some believe a depression encompasses only the period affected by the declining economic activity, when you have other economists argue that a depression continues up until the point that most economic activity has returned to normal.
Well, that's an excellent point, Melody, and it's times like these that you almost wish we had one of these nonpartisan experts available to clarify. But that's essentially it. I mean, the Great Depression lasted roughly a decade. It's considered to be the worst economic downturn in the history of the entire industrialized world. After years of reckless investing and speculation, the stock market bubble burst on Black Thursday, October 24th, 1929, and a huge sell-off began with a record 13 million shares traded, which was a heck of a lot for that time in our history. 5 days later, the Dow Jones fell 12% in another mass sell-off, triggering the start of the Great Depression. Now, although the Great Depression began in the U.S., its economic impact was felt around the world for more than a decade. And I wish we had more time, and perhaps we can do this as a follow-up, Melody, is talk about the role that gold was playing in the economies of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And other nations at this time. because we know right around this time is when, for example, the Federal Reserve was created. But in any event, the Great Depression was characterized by a huge drop in consumer spending and investment, and by devastating unemployment, poverty, hunger, and political unrest. Again, sound familiar, Melody?
It does.
Wages slid 42%. Real estate prices declined 25%. Total economic output virtually cut in half to $55 billion. And many investors' portfolios became completely worthless.
Is it different today? Or how is it different today?
Well, that's the crux, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, like it or not, nowadays the Fed typically reacts more quickly to unemployment and inflation, usually can't get out of its way, whether it's rising, falling, or stagnant. And it's shown more willingness to use especially expansionary monetary policy to lift the economy during downturns.
And we now know that these efforts have led to 36.5 million Americans filing unemployment claims over the past couple of months, with an unemployment headline of 14.7, but we know it's higher and headed higher. It's probably over 20%, Dave.
Well, indeed. And the Atlanta Fed estimated last Friday that second quarter data so far pointing to a 42% drop in GDP, the worst the U.S. have ever seen by far. And I think right before this program started, we saw government estimates, other government estimates of a 38% drop. That's on the verge of Great Depression numbers. But Powell tried to reassure, you know, listeners that, hey, or viewers, because of an active Fed and Congress, it should be a much shorter downturn than you would associate with the 1930s. He did caution, and here's the catch, that a full recovery may not happen until a vaccine is found for the coronavirus. He added, we'll get back to the place we were in February. We'll get to an even better place than that. Now, for you Star Wars fans out there, in Yoda speak, ever the optimist, Pal is. A good prognosticator, however, he isn't. Now, rightly prefacing his enthusiasm, Pal did add, assuming there's not a second wave of the coronavirus, and we know that's a big if, I think you'll see the economy recover steadily through the second half of the year. He just can't help himself.
No, I know it. And, you know, thinking that we're going to be in, even in a better place than we were in February, things were already to turn negative in February before the virus even hit.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, tell me how much debt is going to be paid off during this downtime.
Yep. And in addition, the Fed's in the midst of an unprecedented multi-trillion dollar purchase of corporate and municipal bonds.
Well, you know, whatever, I mean, I guess it is what it is to some extent. Powell is continuing what he's paid to do, in my humble opinion, try to do his best to prop up the volatile paper markets and a failing economy. Now, on the one hand, I guess, good for him for pushing optimism among consumers. I mean, after all, ours is a consumer economy at its heart, almost 70% of our GDP. On the other hand, unlike what Powell's suggesting, it seems like all the signals are pointing to a steep and prolonged recession, even if not an eventual depression. But some of the numbers are equivalent to that already, or approaching it. Finding a safe treatment for COVID-19, not to mention a vaccine worthy of widespread trust, is going to take a minimum of 12 to 18 months, most people tell us, and that would be record time. You know, in the meantime, the uncertainty of returning to work and life in this new normal is going to make this downturn one for the ages, I'm afraid, but one for gold as well.
Absolutely. I mean, gold doesn't... it's a no-brainer for gold and silver. It's absolutely a no-brainer. You know, there's always a lot of talk about the WHO. You know, you can debate both. You hear a lot of people talking it's good, it's bad, and so forth. And I do a lot of I do believe a lot of these agencies are antiquated. And we do need to, other countries do need to step up to the pump and start paying their own fair share. And if, you know, again, I think if they, you know, either, so, I mean, I do agree with President Trump trying to negotiate things. And again, he has threatened to permanently halt funding for the WHO if it doesn't commit to improvements within 30 days and to reconsider U.S. membership in the agency. We know that President Trump did suspend U.S. contributions to the WHO last month, accusing it of promoting Chinese disinformation and about the novel virus outbreak. And the WHO officials, of course, denied that accusation and said China was transparent and open. And I don't think China was anything but transparent and open. But what I want to know is, other than throwing, you know, various accusations against China, what are the improvements? What are the do you know what the improvements are that Trump wants from the WHO?
Well, I suspect, and I'm not sure we'll ever hear this, is that he just wants it to be gone. But on the surface, you know, assuming that he either wants it to continue or at least wants that to be the official opinion, then I suspect that he's more interested in ensuring that the next director general of the WHO is someone that Trump has a lot of faith in and trust in. But that, I believe, I don't know a whole lot about the history here, but the U.S. historically has really been the ones to bring leadership to the table at the WHO. Now, funding, obviously, is can or the lack thereof can certainly make a big statement. You know, even though the Chinese, that Xi Jinping has just announced a $2 billion pledge for WHO.
Oh, we're at that break time. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. You know, lots of times we talk about the car dealerships. We saw a big change. A lot of them just closed up, and during the Great Recession of 2008, big dealerships closed up, lots bulls down, a lot of them consolidated, where you had one dealership selling maybe one or two U.S. brands. Now all of a sudden they're selling all the brands. And so they got hurt bad. And now the question is, are the car dealerships a thing of the past? There are nearly 16,700 franchised car dealerships in America. Last year, they sold just over 17.1 million cars, sport utility vehicles, crossovers, and light pickups. Analysts believe that the figure is going to drop to as low as 13 million. And if there's a large second wave of the virus in the fall and winter, you could see that number go even lower. So you're going to have hundreds of dealers that likely will close. The lowest annual car sales number in the past four decades was 10.4 billion in 2009 at the bottom of the Great Recession. General Motors caught 1,100 dealers. Chrysler dropped 789. Other manufacturers closed hundreds. There simply wasn't enough unit sales to support the network. And dealers sold the fewest cars were the most likely to be shuttered, Dave.
Yeah, I guess it's anyone's guess how many dealers will close this year and next due to our current crisis. In many cases, we read the car companies won't need to take much action. Dealers will simply run out of money, as many other small businesses already have. So what, we're going to be the cost to car companies? Well, I guess it depends on the methods of sale in the future. People are already becoming used to picking and even buying cars online. Dealers only deliver them, the cars. That raised the question whether sales departments of dealers are going to be important at all going forward. I mean, I think they still serve a useful purpose non-pandemic times particularly, but dealers make most of their money on car servicing. So a fear of infection persists. You know, former dealer service department could be combined into brand service centers. The dealer building could simply become obsolete. So could be that car dealerships may become something like restaurants. That is, they're places fewer people will go to, and places that become unnecessary will just start to close down.
You can even throw in the bank branches as things become more, you know, computerized, and, you know, where you don't need to go into the branch anymore. I mean, look, you know, people talk about bank runs. I says, we have a half of a bank run. Most of your branches have been shut down for the past 3 months. You still could go through the drive-through. You can make an appointment to go in, but in all, they were still shut down, not closed totally, but it's kind of a desensitizing type, something we got used to. Look how quickly we got used to it without making any complaints and doing any bank runs and standing in line wanting to get our things out and so forth. You know, people do a lot of banking online now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could see a whole lot more of these branches shutting down. You know, maybe just the local branches, you know, instead of having three branches, just one to accommodate the local clients. And I've been buying cars online basically for about 10 years, Dave. Because I just got tired of going in, into the dealership the way they treat women.
Oh yeah,
you know, they just treat you like you're an idiot, and they always want to know who
they're. I was gonna say they're looking over your head to see where
the
your
husband is. Yeah. The decision maker.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, jeez.
So, you know, I started calling around going on the internet, finding out what the prices are, build your own car. You know what you pay for, so you can reduce it. You know how you want to negotiate, where you want to pay, and, you know, it makes it real easy. So.
Well, like I like to say, Melody, I'm the boss of my family. Just that my wife makes all the decisions.
Right. You know, 40% of Americans won't buy products made in Japan, and it's not quite a new Cold War yet, but maybe just a cold shoulder. 40% of Americans say they won't buy products from China. That's according to a survey of over 1,000 adults. It was conducted last week by FTI Consulting. It's a business advisory firm. That compares with 22% who say they won't buy from India, 17% who refuse to purchase from Mexico, and 12% who boycott goods from Europe.
Wow. Hmm.
The poll also found that 55% don't think China can be trusted to follow through on its trade deal commitments signed in January to buy more U.S. products. 78% said they'd be willing to pay more for products if the company that made them moved manufacturing out of China. You know, it's always funny, people always talk about moving manufacturing out of China, but they don't say where. To where?
Mm-hmm.
It's not coming here.
Vietnam. Cambodia, Singapore.
66% said they favor raising import restrictions over the pursuit of free trade deals as a better way to boost the U.S. economy. For observers of trade policy, the last point is striking because a large majority in the U.S. have traditionally shunned protectionism. According to Gallup, almost 80% of Americans embrace international commerce as an opportunity rather than a threat, a number that's steadily risen over the past decade. And, you know, Dave, I mean, it's not to buy things from any of these countries. That means you better start saving a lot of money.
How about it?
I learned a long time ago in an automobile, it can say made in the U.S. of A, but that means it was just put together here in the U.S. of A. Most of, you know, probably 80% of the parts come from somewhere else.
Yeah, it's a very interesting supply chain, depending on the product you're talking about. Cars being probably the most fascinating, some might say the most deceptive. But it would be really interesting to delve into in a lot more detail. We'd probably spend a whole program on it, going through some of the major products, you know, Americans buy, and looking at the supply chain of all the components. There's a question now of. 2 years after the tariff wars, especially between the U.S. and China, U.S. public opinion, Americans' opinion about our chief economic rival appears to be souring. It could embolden some of China's harsher critics in the country. Huge potential consequences for financial markets above and beyond what we're already feeling. But the back and forth between the White House and Beijing now, certainly not good for anybody. FTI survey from last week showed 86% of respondents say the U.S. relies too heavily on foreign supply chains, and I suspect that that's geared primarily toward China. Melody.
We know it's interesting as we talk about this, how do you decouple? There was a March survey of members of the American Chamber of Commerce in China. 44% of respondents said it's not possible for the two economies to decouple. And that's down from 66% polled in October. So it's kind of interesting. I don't know if there's any other details that are kind of important. to add to that, Dave?
I don't think so.
All right. Here's one. We got a few minutes left of the program today. There's bank restrictions on the financing of oil and gas drilling in the Arctic are akin to past practices known as redlining, of not loaning to communities of color, Energy Secretary Dan Brulé said. Five of America's six too-big-to-fail banks have recently announced they won't finance oil and gas development in the Arctic, prompting conservatives and industry backlash. Brulé said, for years and years and years, banks would not lend money, insurance companies would not write policies in minority areas in the country. We didn't want banks redlining certain parts of the country. We don't want that here. I do not think banks should be redlining our oil and gas investment across this country. Experts said, though, that the redlining comparison is both inappropriate and inaccurate. It's offensive and astounding that they would go there, said Mirza Baradarin, which is a law professor at university. I don't know if that's a male or female name.
That's a good question. I didn't see any personal pronouns before or after.
They are a law professor at the University of California, Irvine. But a massive corporation being cut off from a few banks is absolutely nothing like the systematic exclusion and exploitation of black communities for hundreds of years. Yeah, I don't know what all that is about, Dave. Are they going to... So they've actually cut the finance?
Yeah, I mean, since last December.
And that's Goldman, their reason?
Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, Citi, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase.
But that's the reason?
Their execs have announced. That, well, it's propaganda. It's public relations that they won't finance new oil and gas development in the Arctic. It's probably a public imaging thing. I see Jamie Dimon behind this, who's talked for at least the past year about the need for his peers, the major banking corporations and others, to show more, in his words, corporate responsibility. Environmental stewardship. That's my own take on where this is coming from. It's unknown how much oil and gas is in that area, particularly the National Wildlife Refuge there. And in the whole scheme of things, apparently we're not talking about huge amounts of money. Although, a billion here and a billion there, and sooner or later you're talking about some significant fracking developments, I suppose. But isn't
there a lot of Russian sites in the Arctic?
Well, yeah, I mean, in Siberia, on the other side of the, what is it, the Bering Strait, the Arctic Ocean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on their side, not in Alaska. And I think certainly what's been driving a lot of this has got to be the fact that since the Valdez incident, the amount of oil production in Alaska has been declining, steadily, the point now where, all that annual cash payment that all Alaskans got used to for a number of years, a couple decades, several decades, in fact, is whittling down to peanuts.
Interesting
stuff.
I think this is kind of interesting, but I don't think this is just related to, we're just about out of time. I don't think this is just strictly related to the pandemic, but they're using the pandemic as bringing another crisis to the U.S., and that's mental health impacts. that will likely be felt for years to come. Experts are concerned that the U.S. healthcare system isn't prepared for the potential mental health crisis. Over one quarter of Americans report worsening mental health, and 34% report worsening emotional well-being at the end of April. These mental health effects are likely caused by the combination of media coverage, the economy, and quarantines in place around the country. And experts say this doesn't mean a stay-at-home orders and social distancing shouldn't occur, but the health system needs to be prepared for the mental health effects caused by these life-saving policies. And, you know, one of my neighbors, he's a psychologist, and his business has picked up in a year to where he used to work a couple days, and now he's working like 5 days a week from 9 to 7. And so we've seen this mental health issue increasing for whatever reason, and now this is obviously adding even more to that area. And I just think to myself, Dave, yeah, these are serious times, and you know, it does put people out of whack to some degree, but I find it, I mean, you have to already be a little bit, have a problem. And I don't mean that, you know, in a bad way or anything, just trying to appreciate why this number is increasing like it is in the past, in just 3 short months. But that's another topic for another day. We'll see if we can't get the answers for you. We'll be back tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. Please be safe. Until then, good night and God bless.
Bye-bye. In my dreams.